Hello and welcome to Holden Village. Today is August 18th, 2006. Today's session is entitled, Can We Use Economic Tools to Love Our Holy Land Neighbors? It's presented by Charles Lutz. It is number LUC 2006-05. Let's listen in.
Media person, we're going to start now. Yesterday we talked really about our response to the question, what can I do in terms of our behavior as political beings? What can we do as citizens? What can we do as citizens of the United States to advocate for a just peace between Israel and Palestine? Today we're going to talk about what we can do as economic beings. What can we do with our money? And that includes the issue of our investments or divestment, which has been very controversial in the last couple of years with regard to behavior, particularly by churches in the world and churches in the United States with their investments. And we'll talk about that some, but we're going to talk about other aspects, too, of the use of our money. And I put on the board a list of how our money can be used, and we'll talk about each of those verbs in terms of this political conflict. Our money can be given away, it can be spent, we buy things, we can use it as purchasing power. It can be loaned, that's really the area of investing. Not giving it away or spending it, but letting somebody else have the use of it for a time, but it's still our money. And it can be paid in taxes, right? That may not be a voluntary activity, but it's a required thing for some of our money. So we'll talk a little bit about each of those as it relates to the Holy Land conflict. And I have a document that I'll pass around, and I hope it'll pretty much reach. I think if you are willing to share it with a friend or a partner who may be with you, I think it'll reach. It's a piece on divestment by a guy named David Wildman, and it's, I think, a very well-done analysis of the entire issue of not only divesting or investing, but also of boycotts and intentional purchasing as it relates to the Israel-Palestine situation. David is the Executive Secretary for Human Rights and Racial Justice with the United Methodist Church's Board of Ministries. That's what he does for a living, but he's also been very much involved in the Israeli-Palestinian situation over the years. And he's an advocate of divestment and of boycotting and so forth. But whether you agree or not with his position, I think you'll find this a useful summary of the strategies and the value or not value of the strategies that he's talking about. And a lot of it is also written in the context of the experience of the churches and of the world community with the anti-apartheid uses of economic leverage back in the 70s and 80s. So we can donate our money, we can spend our money, we can lend our money, and we do pay taxes, and all of those have something to do with the general topic that we're talking about today. Let me begin by giving a quick overview of the investment or divestment strategy and where we are and what the fallout from that has been. It really became a matter of awareness for most of the American public, I think, in 2004, when the media gave a lot of attention to the action by the Presbyterian Church USA at their General Assembly, not to divest, but to explore divesting from companies, U.S. companies, in which they had investments. U.S. companies which were, as they put it in their action, supporting the occupation, supporting in whatever manner, the Israeli occupation of Palestinian territory. And the company that was most often mentioned as an example of that was, do you know? Based in Peoria, Illinois.
John Deere.
Oh, John. No? Caterpillar. Caterpillar. Because Caterpillars, Caterpillar machines, not just any Caterpillar machines, but Caterpillar machines explicitly made for the purpose, were being used by the Israeli government. In fact, some of them were even provided to the Israeli government by the American taxpayer as part of our military aid to Israel. They were being used, and they were designed to be used, for demolition of houses. Demolition of Palestinian houses that were in the path of the wall that was being constructed, or that were in the way of settlements that the Israelis were establishing on the West Bank, or that were simply being torn down because the Israeli government didn't want Palestinians living there, and usually under the argument that they didn't have a building permit. And that's the way, basically, the Israeli government has dealt with the expansion of Palestinian residential area. You may recall that just shortly before that, an American peace activist named Rachel Corrie had been run over by one of these Caterpillar bulldozers in Gaza. You remember that? And killed. At any rate, there were other companies, too, that later were identified by the Presbyterians as under scrutiny for, you know, do they deserve to have Presbyterian investments in their capital because of their behavior with regard to the support of the occupation. Well, the reaction to that was not only from the American Jewish community, but from within the Presbyterian Church and in other churches, was very dicey. There was a lot of anger about that action. Even though they hadn't yet voted any divestments, they were exploring it. It was part of what the churches generally have been doing for at least 30 years, called corporate social responsibility, and putting investment funds in corporations that behave or that do things that fit with the values of the investing party. It's not just churches, but other entities as well. But there's been a corporate social responsibility movement that includes dialogue with companies about how they behave. It includes filing shareholder resolutions at times to try to change the activity or the behavior of the company. And the, you know, the last resort is to withdraw investments, to divest. It also implies, on the positive side, affirmative investing in companies that are doing things that fit with the values of the investing party. The churches and even private investors, I think, for a long time have applied certain screens to their investment policy. For example, my church, the Evangelical Lutheran Church in America, and its predecessor bodies, has never invested in tobacco, alcohol production, from about, I think, 1980s on, in companies that are involved with weapons production. What else is ruled out?
Gambling?
Gambling, yeah. So, you know, for a long time, we've had certain screens to screen out certain kinds of investments from companies that are engaged in activities that the churches don't want to support. But the reaction in the Jewish community in the U.S. was particularly virulent and very angry, and it didn't represent all of the U.S. Jews or all of the U.S. Jewish organizations, but the mainline Jewish organizations were just livid about that, because as they saw it, it was comparing the behavior of Israel, the government of Israel, to the behavior of the South African apartheid regime, because that was the last significant time that churches and others in the world community used divestment as a strategy to affect change. And that strategy, as you may know, may remember, had some effect. It wasn't just churches in the North that were doing it. It was governments. It was all kinds of different actors worldwide that were exercising economic sanctions against the white minority regime in South Africa to try to bring down apartheid, to try to bring down change. And there are observers to this day who claim that it was the single most significant factor in bringing about that change. Desmond Tutu and others who have written about it, talk about it, say, and Nelson Mandela, that was the most important significant factor. The impact on South Africa's economic situation of a variety of sanctions that were exercised by the governments of the world. On that point, let me just read to you the conclusion of David Wildman's article. In the year of 1985, the number of campuses that voted to divest, and it was a very active thing on college campuses as well, that voted to divest from South Africa doubled. Suddenly it became fashionable for college faculty, students, churches, trade unions, even state legislators and the U.S. Congress to get arrested doing civil disobedience, blocking entrances to South African consulates. Soon thereafter, the U.S. Congress overrode President Reagan's veto to enact the Comprehensive Anti-Apartheid Sanctions Act. And that was all about economic leverage, economic tools. Among other things, it forbade any future investment or development by U.S. companies in South Africa. That was enacted by our Congress over a presidential veto. This is the hope of boycott, divestment, sanctions campaigns, that the global movement and public visibility of nonviolent moral pressures around the world will grow and match the nonviolent resistance of Palestinians and of Israeli human rights advocates until that day when justice and equality replace occupation and apartheid. He's referring there, of course, to the Israeli-Palestinian situation. But the Palestinian, or the American Jewish organizations, for the most part, were enraged by that Presbyterian action. And they sought dialogue with the Presbyterians. They sometimes said it was an anti-Semitic act on the part of the Presbyterians in the U.S. And remember that the Presbyterians hadn't yet divested anything. They had just voted to explore it. And it was called a phased, selective divestment campaign that they were to undertake. And they couldn't really, as a church, by their own rules, they couldn't do any divesting until the next General Assembly, which was held this summer, 2006. Well, what did that General Assembly do? It still didn't vote to do any actual divesting, but it revised the language of the action, softened it, many feel. Let me see if I can find it here. The new, more concise language, which was adopted in place of the paragraph on phased selective divestment, now reads, to urge that financial investments of the PCUSA, as they relate to Israel, Gaza, East Jerusalem, and the West Bank, be invested in only peaceful pursuits, and affirm that the customary corporate engagement process of our denomination is the proper vehicle for achieving this goal. That means to, before you do any divesting or make any new investment decisions, to have dialogue with the company and to file shareholder resolutions, etc. So that's the Presbyterian experience to date. Other churches have taken similar actions. The World Council of Churches Central Committee, within, I think, the past year, has asked its member churches to consider using divestment as one kind of economic tool with regard to the Israel-Palestine conflict. The United Church of Christ, I'll read you the action they took in 2005. It's part of a policy on use of economic leverage in promoting peace in the Middle East. It asked that national agencies of that church, congregations and members use economic leverage, including but not limited to advocating the reallocation of U.S. aid, so that the militarization of the Middle East is constrained, making positive contributions to groups and partners committed to the nonviolent resolution of the conflict, challenging the practices of corporations that gain from the continuation of the conflict, and divesting from those companies that refuse to change their practice of gain from the perpetuation of violence, including the occupation. The ELCA, adopted in Orlando, Churchwide Assembly in 2005, a strategy on engagement with the Middle East and the Israel-Palestine situation called Peace Not Walls. And it has a section on economic resources, but it doesn't use the word divestment. And there are some who've been critical of the ELCA for not daring to mention divestment. It says that U.S. tax dollars should go to both Palestinians and Israelis with equity and on condition that aid be used only for economic growth and humanitarian needs. And it says both members and church organizations should make investment decisions with concern for their impact on the lives of all Holy Land peoples who suffer from the ongoing conflict. But clearly it doesn't talk about divesting. It also, that ELCA document urges consumer decisions that favor support to those in greatest need. And then it says explicitly, for example, Palestinian providers as distinct from Israeli settlers on Palestinian territory. And we'll get to that in a minute. And where that kind of campaign, boycott and intentional purchasing, is going. But let me stop there and see if you have any questions, concerns about the divestment campaign. By the way, the positive side of that is to explicitly put investments in companies that are doing things that the churches want to support in Palestine. My own closest experience to that is I have a daughter-in-law who works for Land O'Lakes Agricultural Co-op, a rather large corporation now that is based in the Twin Cities. And Land O'Lakes for a long time had a plant in Ramallah in the West Bank. They have since closed it. They've withdrawn. But there was a time when some of us were advocating that we put church investments in Land O'Lakes to help support that kind of effort in the West Bank. And there are other examples. Much of the difficulty in the West Bank in the last 5 years has been that companies don't want to invest there because of the violence, because of the intifada. And they've been not only not expanding there, but they've been withdrawing. So anyway, let's talk a little bit, if you want, about divestment and investment as one strategy and see what concerns or questions you may have about that. Any of you had any experience with the debate on this?
Well, I would just say, like, you picked on Caterpillar. I mean, to me, it just says you're going to pick on Caterpillar, who's a leading producer of construction equipment mm-hmm. throughout the mm-hmm. world, and then you're going to give that market share to Komatsu and out of Japan. I mean, it doesn't seem to me to be a very effective way to penalize that company because of their distributor, those construction pieces of equipment mm-hmm. end up in Palestine or wherever they end up. I mean, you're just giving the market share to somebody else.
Yeah. The fact is, as I see it, and I think this was also true during the anti-apartheid campaign of the 70s and 80s, the fact is that the entire strategy of divestment and economic sanctions, maybe in general, does not have much, at least immediate, economic impact. It is more a way of making a statement. It's a way of making a proclamation of your stance and bringing a kind of moral judgment on what is going on. And that's certainly how the American Jewish communities read it. They said, this isn't going to hurt Israel at all, but you're making a judgment. You're making a moral judgment about the behavior of Israel, and we don't like it. So, yeah.
Well, and I remember reading about IBM, who was one of the largest employers, not largest, but the largest employer in South Africa. And when they got the pressure from stockholders and so forth to get out of South Africa, and they did. But they were one of the few companies in South Africa that they had the same rules of their management that the American companies mm-hmm. had, that you could not discriminate on the basis of race and so forth and so on. So that company in South Africa employed a lot of black
yep.
executives who I think got hurt
yep.
when IBM pulled up or turned it over to local ownership.
I remember in those years as part of a delegation from my own church, the American Lutheran Church, talking with 3M executives in St. Paul, in which we had investments, and talking with them about their behavior in South Africa and about the economic pressure that the churches and others were trying to bring to topple the apartheid system. And we talked with them about, we never did divest from 3M, but we talked with them about maybe withdrawing from South Africa. And their response was along the lines of what you're saying. They're saying, we're one of the better actors in South Africa in terms of employment practices, in terms of helping workers to become more skilled, you know, training, worker training and so on, and in benefits to our workers, and employing non-whites. So yeah, that was part of the entire debate in that period about whether economic pressures accomplish good or ill toward your final goal. Yeah.
One question. I was in South Africa and Namibia in 1985, part of a Lutheran sort of travel and study tour there. And of course, the investment divestment issue was alive and well in 85.
Yeah.
One of the things that we asked scores upon scores of black South Africans was, what were their opinions of it? Where was their position on divestment? And in sort of a broad, generalized response that we got, almost without fail, was because a lot of people said it won't make the black people suffer more if 3M, IBM, Capital, whatever,
yeah.
pull out. They said, please don't talk to us about suffering. We know how to suffer. We don't want it just made better to be under the paternal thumb of the apartheid regime. The only thing that was going to bring down that regime, or at least contribute to that, that was their concern, bringing
yeah.
down the regime, making those changes.
There had to be a system change.
Right.
Yeah.
But also the question now, and this is part of my question, we dealt with it then, it's happening now, is how do you get the church, I guess other than just count noses, to say this is what we as a church feel we should do on the issue itself, supporting who and what will be helpful, what will not.
Yeah. Well, it was a big and divisive debate in the 70s and 80s, I remember, and it was never put to a vote of all the members of the referendum of all the members of the church, but it was voted on in national conventions, delegate bodies, and even there it was quite divisive. You know, it was a close vote, and I think the debate also had to do with whether the fiduciary responsibility of the boards that were managing the church's investments, most of which were pension funds, invested for the retirement of church workers, the future retirement of church workers, whether it was ethical, not to mention legal, for them to take actions with social goals rather than best return on investment goals. That was also a part of the debate and continues to be, I think, to this day. Yeah.
But part of the problem, and I like your comment on this, the issues were fuzzy somewhat then.
Yes, yes.
I think with regard to the Middle East today, it's even fuzzier with the average American on what is the right decision.
I think you're right. Yeah, I think you're right. Yes, Cynthia.
Divestment is one economic strategy amongst many. They mm-hmm. need to work together.
Yeah.
And in one of the church statements that you read, I can't remember which one, it may have been the UCC, you read a list of economic strategies,
yeah.
including shifting USAID and challenging corporations that gain from the occupation. I imagine that means shareholder kinds of challenging and conversation.
Yes.
And and then divestment, and then also consumer advocacy through purchasing power,
right.
and boycotts.
Yeah.
Can you fill out that list? Is there more that's missing from that list?
That's pretty much, I think that was in the UCC statement, what I read, but that's pretty much the same list in the ELCA statement.
Oh.
It really talks about everything we're going to talk about this afternoon. It talks about investing or it doesn't use the word divestment, but it talks about investment strategy.
Mm-hmm.
It talks about purchasing power, boycotts, and intentional purchasing, which is the opposite of boycotts.
Mm-hmm.
It talks about U.S. aid,
mm-hmm.
government aid, taxpayer supported aid, and it talks about support to ministries of the churches in the region and the humanitarian ministries of the international church that we're supporting. So it talks about all of those things in a list of what is titled Stewarding Financial Resources. That's the category. Stewarding, what is good stewardship, prudent stewardship, ethical stewardship of financial resources. Yeah. By the way, the ELCA's statement and engagement strategy called Peace Not Walls is available online if you go to www.elca.org, and then you can find that statement, that action that came out of the Orlando Assembly last summer. Well, let's talk a little bit now about our spending decisions. I think all of you are probably old enough to remember the Nestle boycott. You remember that back in the 70s and maybe went into the 80s? You remember the boycotts of lettuce and grapes? That was a way of support, consumer boycotts, a way of supporting the United Farm Workers in their effort to get better deals from their employers, the migrant workers. We've had some experience with that, and there was some effectiveness in those boycott efforts. Today, in Israel-Palestine, there is a movement that is actually supported by one of the Israeli peace groups. Gush Shalom supports an international boycott of products that are made or grown, manufactured or produced, in the settlements in the West Bank. The European Union nations, in their trade agreement with the State of Israel, have a ruling that they will not buy products and sell them in European countries that come from the settlements. That hasn't really caught on in the United States and Canada yet very much, but there are some who are talking about that as a way to go. And the of course, products have to be identified by origin. Where do they come from? Do they come from within Israel proper or from the West Bank, Israeli settlements? But what has caught on, I think, in the U.S. and Canada to a larger degree is the other side of it, the intentional purchasing of goods and products from Palestinians. And a lot of it is happening through the churches. It includes olive oil, which is the main agricultural export from the West Bank. It includes craft items from Palestinian producers, olive wood carvings, a lot of the things that traditionally were sold to tourists or to pilgrims, who now in larger numbers are not coming. But ceramics, embroidery, Palestinian embroidery, and so forth. And there have been organized efforts, at least in the upper Midwest. I know of one major effort in Fargo-Moorhead area, and one major effort based in the Twin Cities to bring these goods in and make them available for purchase in mostly in local churches, though they're sometimes available in other settings as well. And it's a way of helping Palestinian producers who are not able to make their products available to tourist visitors or in other ways. And so that, I think, has gotten quite a fair amount of support in the churches of North America, and it's something that you may want to look into in your area. There are ways of getting those products. the Jubilee Shop in Leavenworth. Any of you been there? It's operated by the Schramms, John and Mary, who used to be directors of Holden Village. They have goods from Palestine that they sell in their shop, both craft items and olive oil. And so there are ways that these kinds of activities can be carried out through marketing arrangements in the U.S. The Mount of Olives Lutheran land, on the top of the Mount of Olives where the hospital, Augusta Victoria, is located, has quite a few olive groves surrounding the hospital. And the Mount of Olive, or the Lutheran World Federation, is marketing olive oil worldwide through the churches from the Mount of Olives as a way of helping to not only provide some employment for Palestinians who work the olive groves and do the harvesting and turning it into olive oil, but as a way of raising money for the hospital. And I don't know if any of you have run into Mount of Olives olive oil in your churches or self, or elsewhere, but I see it in Minnesota, in churches. My own congregation sells it, makes it available. And so it's another way of providing an economic tool, an economic support for Palestinian people. The last area I want to talk about before we talk a little bit about USAID is our giving. And this is not new to us. We've always given to ministries of the church worldwide that that our denominations are part of. And that continues to be not only a need, but an opportunity today. The international church, the church internationally, has always had a lot of ministries, mostly in healthcare and in education in the Middle East, in the Holy Land. And that certainly continues. That continues to be a need. We, in the ELCA this year, the first half of the summer, brought a touring dance group from the Lutheran School of Hope in Ramallah to the U.S. to perform. And I don't know if any of you had a chance to see them. The El Raja, which means hope, dance troupe from the Lutheran School of Hope, both Muslim and Christian youth, as part of that effort, and they, I think, made about 50 appearances around the U.S., including at the youth gathering in San Antonio. As part of that effort, there was fundraising going on for the Palestinian Lutheran schools, for scholarship money for those schools. And there was an effort to raise money for another project that the Lutherans are currently engaged in, which is to build housing on the Mount of Olives for young families, particularly Christian families, who increasingly are being squeezed out of East Jerusalem. That effort is coordinated by the Lutheran World Federation in primarily North America and Europe, seeks to raise $8 million to build 84 units of 84 apartments. It will be rental apartments for families who don't have options for housing currently, and this will, it'll be a drop in the bucket, but it'll be a big drop. And so that effort is seeking $2 million in the U.S., $4 million in Europe, and I think they're going to borrow the last $2 million, and they hope to begin construction later this year and have it ready by about a year from now. I brought along a brochure on that effort, which I can now pass around. And if you're interested in supporting that kind of thing, there's a form in there you can send in with a pledge or a check, and they'll be happy to receive it. So there's that kind of activity, too, that we can do with our economic power, supporting special efforts of that sort that are going to provide some help for some of the people who are suffering from the current conflict. There are many such opportunities, and they're not just church-related, but non-governmental organizations. There's a group in the Bay Area of California that is devoted to raising money for programs to help the children of both Israel and Palestine who are suffering because of the ongoing conflict. It happens to be headed by a woman I know named Barbara Lubin, who is Jewish, who's an American Jew. And it gives support to both Palestinian and Israeli kids. But there are things like that that are going on and that we can be supportive of if we are so minded. U.S. Aid to Israel, U.S. aid to the Holy Land peoples is almost exclusively aid to Israel. We have been giving, since the Camp David agreement under Jimmy Carter between Begin and Sadat, the Egyptian leader, in 1978-79, we have been giving a minimum of $3 billion a year to the Israeli government, with no strings attached. Some years it's more than that, but it's huge. I mean, it's the largest single aid package by far to any government, to any country in the world. And as Jonathan Ferrix told us last evening, if you were here at the forum, it's larger than all of the aid to Africa, to a country of, what, 6.5 million, far more than all of the aid to Africa, which has much greater economic distress than Israel. And our aid currently to the Palestinian Authority, until very recently, was running about 100 and 150 million a year, 5% of the Israeli aid package, but still significant and needed. And most of that had gone through the Palestinian Authority to support social services in Palestine. Including Augusta Victoria Hospital, the Lutheran's hospital on the Mount of Olives. That has been cut off now because of the election of Hamas to a majority of the seats in the Palestinian legislature. We as a government were minded to, in effect, punish the Palestinian people for electing in fair and democratic elections a government that we didn't like. We didn't support, because Hamas has been listed as a terrorist organization by our government and has been unwilling to say it accepts the existence of the State of Israel. So that's a debate that continues in Congress. Should the United States government do that, and should the United States government find other ways of getting aid to support the Palestinian people, even not through its government? So there's that debate that continues to go on. There are many who have said that our aid to Israel, if it can't be reduced or even eliminated, should at least have conditions attached to it. It should say you can't use this money for building the wall. You can't use this money to subsidize settlements. Or if you continue to do such and so, we'll reduce the amount of it. I've talked more than once with my representative, Martin Sabo from Minneapolis, about that, and he's on the House Appropriations Committee, and he's a rather senior member there because he's been in the House for that long. And he says, putting conditions or strings on our aid to Israel. It's the only aid package from the United States government to anywhere in the world that has no conditions on it, no spelling out how it may or may not be used. And Martin's response is, Chuck, that's a great idea, but it'll never happen. In other words, there isn't support in the Congress for putting conditions on our aid to Israel. And I suspect he's right. Unless the will, the political will changes, it'll continue to be that way. But anyway, that's a use of our money too, yours and mine, that has some impact on the region. And Why don't I just stop there and say let's go into some discussion of any of this that you want to talk about, and if you need additional resources for pursuing this analysis of how our money is or can be used, I'll try to give you some ways of finding that. There are a lot of websites where, for example, Gush Shalom, the Israeli peace group, Gush Shalom, has a website in which they list by label all of the products that are made in the West Bank and go into international trade. They tell you what they are. So you can go there and find them, and even when you're shopping, check to see if maybe they are on that list. There's a lot of information, as you know, available online.
What is that website again?
It's Gush Shalom. I'll give you the exact citation here. Gush Shalom is the Israeli Peace Group, and by the way, there are a lot of resources in this book, including websites, but also books and videos, and how to get them, such as the video we saw yesterday from Foundation for Middle East Peace, which isn't in here because that's newer than this book, but there are resources listed here. Gush Shalom. Name of this Israeli group is Hebrew for Peace Block. It provides a list of products produced in Israeli settlements on Palestinian territory and encourages international consumer boycott of the same. www.gush-shalom. You know how to spell shalom. .org. Okay. All right. What do you want to talk about? Yeah.
Well, Chuck, your last statement about that will never happen in Congress. Can you enlighten us about what is in the heart and the mind of congressional folks in that regard, why it would never happen? I mean, it'd be good for us to be in any form of advocacy towards putting limits or restrictions on this aid to know what, in fact, we're up against.
I think it's simply a reflection of the reality that there is not support in Congress among probably 90% of the members for any action that will punish Israel or that will be seen as critical of Israel. It's just not there. To give you an example, on the other side, I was part of a delegation that visited with Betty McCollum, who's a House member from St. Paul, from the eastern side of the Twin Cities metro area. We've visited with her over the years often. She's on the House International Relations Committee. And we talked with her when there was moving through the House, first through that committee, and eventually it was voted on in the full House, a bill to cut off U.S. aid to the Palestinian Authority. And she agreed to oppose that bill and to speak against it, which she did, in the committee and on the House floor, and to say it was not necessary to punish the Palestinian people, who would be the final victims of that action, by cutting off aid to the Palestinian Authority, that we needed to find ways of getting that aid to the Palestinian people by other means, through non-governmental organizations, and so on. She was attacked by AIPAC publicly, the American-Israel Public Affairs Committee, and charged with being a supporter of terrorists because of her action, because of her stance on that bill. And as I recall, she was one of only two members of the House International Relations Committee who voted against it. And maybe there were, I don't know, 20, 15 or 20 in the full House that voted against it. So it's a tiny minority. But when they do take such an action, they get attacked and accused. Betty then said, and this also was very public, she said very publicly, and it was picked up in the media, that she would never again permit to her office to visit with her or with a member of her staff any person from AIPAC until they publicly apologized for calling her a supporter of terrorists. And I don't think she's gotten that public apology yet. But it was courageous on her part to do that, to stand up. And, you know, she's for some time, I expect, going to suffer from that. And it's not just from voters who may be Jewish. It's from others who agree with the lobbying of AIPAC and groups of that sort, that you never criticize Israel. You never do anything that is seen as negative to the state of Israel. And that's the mood of the Congress. Frankly, the Congress has been worse for many years on such questions than the administration, I think, Republican or Democrat. And the Congress is bad from both parties. Doesn't make much difference. The Democrats are as bad as the Republicans, I think. Yeah?
Well, it strikes me that a part of that attitude of Congress is a reflection of a larger worldview that sees virtually the entire Arab world against Israel, as opposed to this being an Israeli-Palestine question.
Yeah.
And as you pointed out, there are now three countries that have, well, at least two. It's not clear to me where Lebanon stands. There are folks that say war has never ended between Israel and Lebanon, and that Israel is therefore justified in going in.
Lebanon has not signed a peace agreement with Israel.
Okay. So we've got Jordan.
Jordan and Egypt have.
Most of the discussions this week, there's been very little mention of the other Arab nations, and certainly the whole spin, if you will, that I get reading news in Seattle, Washington, is about a general Muslim worldwide growth that may be spearheaded by a radical fringe amongst the Muslims, but which nonetheless reflects a general desire for that growth.
Yeah. Incidentally, you had in Seattle recently a killing of some staff person in a Jewish organization by a Muslim.
Yes.
Who apparently was doing it in the name of Islam.
Yeah, I haven't heard the resolution, but the prosecutors are trying to figure out whether or not to charge him with a hate crime.
Yeah. Yes.
One of the concerns that I have, when you try to put conditions on things, the government of Israel is probably not unlike the government of, or the government, the leadership of corporations in terms of how budgets are arrived at. If you say you can't use these dollars to do this, you shift line items in the budget and you use some other part of the budget to do the piece that you said you can't do and you replace it.
There's a term for that. Is it fungible?
Fungible.
Money is fungible.
So I think
money here can replace money here. And,
exactly.
Yeah.
I think if we're going to put conditions, we have to do the conditions the other way around and say this money can only be used for the following kinds of activities. And if not, you don't get it. That's going to have, I think, more of an impact than saying we're not going to give it to you if you do this, this, and this.
The other thing you can do, which is putting conditions on the money, is to say if you continue doing such and so, we will reduce the amount of the aid by this proportion. We did something like that under George Bush the First, when the Israelis were in a major expansion of settlements, and he said, and they wanted a loan guarantee from the United States government, which meant, and that's been the case for a long time, apparently with loan guarantees from the United States Treasury, you can get a lower interest rate on what you borrow in the world capital market. George Bush the First said, we will not give you a loan guarantee as long as you continue to expand settlements. I think the Israelis continued doing it anyway, but for a time we would not, as a government, give a loan guarantee. So that's another way of perhaps going. But Cynthia?
That story that you just told suggests that there is some possibility of impacting U.S. public policy towards Israel. Mm-hmm. Even though previously Martin Sabo said nothing will ever change in Congress. So is there is there concerted effort to change U.S. public policy, and how do you define the change that's needed? What is, in other words, if we're to become, I'm thinking of the person back here that said, how do we go forward at all? If we're to become, as a church, advocates for a change in U.S. public policy, it's important to know what that change would be. So can you speak to that a little bit? Is it, can you, Chuck, just kind of summarize or say how to get the best summary of that?
Yeah, and the best summary that would use is what the Churches for Middle East Peace organization is advocating for and lobbying for. And they represent 21 Orthodox, Catholic, and Protestant agencies in Washington, which are the public policy voices of our churches. And they, including the ELCA, Methodists, Presbyterians, United Church of Christ, Episcopalians, etc. And they basically, for 20 years, have been calling for four or five things in a U.S. package. And they're basically to implement U.N. Security Council resolutions that have been adopted since the 1967 war. An end to the occupation, that is, the United States government should insist or demand that there be an end to the occupation, a withdrawal by the Israeli military behind the Green Line, the 1967 boundary, and a return to the peace table, to the peace talks, which periodically our government has engineered over the years, most recently Bill Clinton in the late year of his second term. Right now, and since 2000, there hasn't been any formal conversation between representatives of the Israelis and the Palestinians in peace talks. So now it's been, 6 years since they've even been talking to each other. So a call for a return to peace negotiations, reaching toward a final resolution of the conflict and a resolution of all of the issues at stake, one of which is the settlements, another of which is where should the border, final border be. Another is the sharing of Jerusalem, which is a very tough one, a very hot one, because the Israelis have said ever since 1967 that they will never again allow the division of Jerusalem and the sharing of Jerusalem with the Palestinians. But the Palestinians say that's a sine qua non for them. They will not have what they consider to be a viable state unless East Jerusalem can be its capital and at the heart of it, economically and politically. What else? Some resolution of the refugee problem. What to do with the what are the rights of the Palestinians who were either fled or were forced into exile in 1948, and their children, their descendants. What to do with that? And most observers think that the way to resolve that is not to let them go back to their land in Israel. Israel makes it very clear that they will never allow that, because if they did, it would no longer be a Jewish majority state, because there are about, over 4 million now refugees and their descendants. But some kind of just recompense for what they lost, some payment. And letting them, many of them settle in the West Bank, if they so choose. But some kind of just financial restitution of their loss. So that's pretty much the agenda. And the basic pressure on our government, I think, needs to be to get involved directly at the highest level, as we were back in the Clinton years and in previous presidencies, Jimmy Carter. Trying to bring about a final just solution. Jimmy Carter really accomplished a great deal in the Camp David talks in 1979, in not just a peace between Israel and Egypt, but it called for the establishment of a Palestinian state. It called for an end of the occupation. But that part of it has never been fulfilled. But it's, it's been there on the table for, 30 years almost. But I think that's the basic agenda. And in general terms, what we ought to be pressing for members of Congress to support and for the White House to support is a more balanced and even-handed policy with regard to Israel-Palestine. Because our policy is always viewed, and worldwide this is true, and it's certainly true in the region, in the Middle East region, as always tilting toward Israel, always being supportive of what Israel wants, and not ever really paying any attention to the Palestinians. And the Camp David talks under Bill Clinton, by most of the observers who write about it, say there too, it was as though the Palestinians had to deal with two Israeli delegations, one from Israel and one from the United States, one with the Israeli flag and one with the American flag, but it was like those two delegations were both over against the Palestinians. And so there's a sense of unfairness in how U.S. policy and U.S. power is applied to the conflict, that we're not viewed as even-handed. We're not viewed as an honest broker, a neutral party between the two. We're viewed always as favoring one side. What else? Anything else you want to talk about? Yes?
I just wanted to ask, how do those refugees, what are they, just in tents? Or, I mean, do they have a community where they can earn a living? Or, I mean, what
speak up a little.
Oh, I'm sorry. How do the refugees, how do they survive? I mean, what do they have? Do they live in tents? Do they have a trade? I mean, what is their plight?
That's a very good question. The refugees, and they're identified by name as refugees under the international system through the UN. They are recognized as refugees and listed as such, and therefore they are entitled to certain kinds of assistance from the international community. At the time that they became refugees, or shortly thereafter, the United Nations established the UN Works and Relief Administration, UNRWA, UN Works and Relief Administration, whose only charge is to care for the Palestinian refugees from the 1948 conflict. What does that mean? That means they operated what were originally called camps, but now they're really permanent settlements, but they're kind of gated communities where people live. And they are all over the Palestinian territories and in adjacent countries. And I've visited with groups a number of times to one in Bethlehem called Dahisha. And there are maybe, 25,000 living in that camp. They go out to work. If they can find work, they go out to jobs during the day. The kids go to school, usually right there in the area where they reside. They have economic activity of various kinds. The women make things to sell to tourists who come and visit. They live reasonably normal lives, but their economic situation is dire. They don't have much economic support.
Unemployment is high, and I would say housing is substandard.
Yeah, right. Yeah.
So it's just not a pleasant area, but people make they've been there for a while, so they...
And they get some basic support from the international community through the United Nations, through UNRWA. They are... what else was I going to say? They are places where anger just festers, I think, because of their living conditions. That's the source of a lot of the suicide bombers, the refugee camps. That's where they come from. That's the source of a lot of the extremist rhetoric and extremist behavior among Palestinians. And it's a bad scene to have to live for what now, almost 60 years with that situation. Many of them have emigrated. There are people, Palestinian Americans, officially classified as refugees in the Twin Cities. I've gotten to know some of them. Some of them are church leaders. Bishop Yonan of the Lutherans is classified as a refugee. I think some of the other church leaders and pastors and so forth are in the Christian community in Palestine. So they don't all live in camps or in these guarded residential areas, but they are there. And somehow it has to be dealt with. What is the final? There is, under international law, something called the right of return. And the right of return says that once a conflict is ended, those who went into refugee status have a right to return to where they came from. And Israel says never. They won't let them back into Israel. So that has to be dealt with in some other way than physical return. Some of the negotiations over the years have talked about a limited number of them being able to go back. Because, you know, they still have kin, some of them, in Israel proper, who stayed, who didn't become refugees, who are still there, and their descendants, and who are citizens of Israel today, non-Jewish citizens of Israel. Yeah?
Quick question. At the time Arafat died, there was speculation in the media that he squirreled away fortunes here and there, but I haven't seen anything or noticed any resolution on that. Can you give us any information?
I really don't know anything about that. I know that there was some claim at one point that there were Swiss bank accounts with some of that money that Arafat had received and squirreled away, but I don't know if there's ever been any real credible research on that, and I don't think there's not been anything done about it that I'm aware of. But there used to be a lot of claim that the Palestinian Authority government and the PLO before it, Palestinian Liberation Organization, which was Arafat's organization, were corrupt, and that one of the measures of corruption was the amount of money that came from around the world to support their cause, which went into the pockets of leadership of the PLO and the Palestinian Authority, and that one of the reasons the Palestinian people turned so heavily to Hamas earlier this year in the legislative races was that Hamas was viewed as honest, honorable, not corrupt. And Fatah, the party of Arafat and others, was viewed as corrupt. Yeah. Thank you.
Thank you.
I have to call it here. And I'll,